From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. It was unlike any interview we've recently heard in the American media. Monday night, veteran BBC anchor David Dimbleby sat down with Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld for a 30-minute conversation that was searching, sharply challenging, and at times full-bore testy.
Regime change will happen there.
Don't put those words in my mouth.
Oh, all right.
Tonight on Point, we're breaking out of our usual format to bring you something out of the ordinary, extended segments of the BBC interview with Donald Rumsfeld, along with live analysis of one of the key players in Washington and the world right now. Coming up, Rumsfeld in the Raw. We begin with the deepening diplomatic split over war with Iraq. Earlier today, in Paris, foreign ministers from France, Russia, and Germany said that they would not allow passage of a UN resolution authorizing war against Iraq. But Secretary of State Colin Powell maintains that Saddam Hussein has thrown away his, quote, one last chance to disarm, and travels to the UN tomorrow to try to salvage a Security Council vote. Michael Hirsch is a senior editor at Newsweek magazine. I asked him where U.S. efforts to corral support for war stand now.
Somewhere in the middle of the stream, and we don't know exactly what it's going to look like on the other side. The news would not seem to be very good for the Americans today in that the French, Russians, and Germans, three members of the UN Security Council, two of whom have vetoes, got together and announced that they would block any attempt to authorize force in Iraq. That doesn't quite close the door, however.
How so?
Well, in a sense, you have to notice the language that they're using. What they don't want is a resolution that automatically authorizes the use of force. Now, the resolution that's about to be tabled by the U.S. and Britain was written in such a way so it would not forthrightly authorize the use of force so as to give these countries some face to save. And there may still be a possibility of negotiating a face-saving solution if the U.S. can agree to give these countries some more time. In other words, give UN inspection some more time.
So you don't see this as a blanket guarantee of a veto of any further UN resolution that might open the door for armed intervention in Iraq?
No, not quite yet. I mean, if you look at the statements, particularly the ones coming from France and Russia, the two countries that have vetoes.
So really matter.
They haven't really closed the door on a resolution. And I think it's becoming much less likely that there will be a diplomatic solution and much more likely that a war will occur without another UN resolution. But I don't rule it out yet because there still is the possibility after the Hans Blix report on Friday, the latest update on Iraq's compliance, for some kind of a deal. Could happen, next week. We just don't know.
How important is it now to Washington to have a further UN Security Council vote to cover any action that might come? Do they really care? Will they portray this as a UN-sanctioned military action whether or not there's a further vote?
They will portray it that way. They'll portray it as an attempt to, save the honor of the UN, and they'll hope that not too many commentators point out that, they're kind of saving the UN in defiance of majority of UN opinion, kind of, destroying the village owner to save it. But they still hope that they can get a resolution. I think for Bush himself, it may not matter as much. It does matter a great deal to his most stalwart ally, Tony Blair, the Prime Minister of Britain. And for that reason, and also to try to bring the Turks and others on board, they still very much would like to see a resolution.
Michael Hirsch, how do you interpret Russia joining France in saying that it would block any move here? Putin and Bush have been famously close. They've seen into one another's souls. What's pushing Russia to the other side of the ledger?
Vladimir Putin, president of Russia, seems to be playing a very cagey game. From what we understand, Bush is not yet disenchanted with him. They still say that the Bush people do privately that they think they can bring Russia on board. Putin, has been always very, very clever at playing a weak hand in the sense that, Russia is not terribly powerful. But here, once again, we see him, playing the swing vote, holding out. But U.S. officials still believe that in the end they can possibly bring Russia on board. Now, what you hear from the Russian officials is, they're not going to abstain. They're going to take sides one way or another. And I think it's a question of whether a face-saving solution, which would probably involve, another several weeks or 30 days more before a war, can be negotiated so that these countries feel they can sign on to a resolution.
Is the United States in a position, if it thinks it will eventually go to war, to give those further 30 days? Colin Powell said today that Saddam Hussein had thrown away, quote, his one last chance to avoid the serious consequences threatened last November. He seems to be saying, listen, this game is over.
Well, yes, they are saying that, but in practical terms, from everything we understand in our reporting, the U.S. still has a ways to go before it's going to be quite ready to invade. They're not ready to do it tomorrow, and I don't think they're even going to be ready to do it by next week, particularly if the Turkish situation can be resolved and they can start to deploy heavy armor in Turkey as they want to. So it may work out for the U.S. plans if they negotiate additional time, much of which they will need anyway, to finally get ready for invasion. I don't think anyone really expects that an attack would occur before the third week or so in March anyway.
Michael Hirsch, thank you for joining us.
Happy to do it.
Michael Hirsch is a senior editor at Newsweek magazine. He spoke with us earlier from Washington. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld is one of the most powerful and charismatic lions in the Bush administration. We're used to seeing him bathed in the heroic glow of the Pentagon press conference, charming and cajoling the U.S. press from behind a microphone-studded podium. Monday night, Donald Rumsfeld stepped out from behind that podium and sat down with BBC anchorman David Dimbleby. What emerged was a conversation unlike anything we've recently heard in the American media bubble around Rumsfeld. The interview was probing, prickly, and strikingly low on American-style reverence for the man on horseback. Tonight we'll bring you extended segments of the interview along with live analysis. What do you hear in the Rumsfeld interview? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now from San Francisco is Dana Priest, National Security and Military Affairs Correspondent for The Washington Post and author of the new book, The Mission, Waging War and Keeping Peace with America's Military. Good evening and welcome, Dana Priest.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Thanks for joining us. We will also be joined in a moment by Justin Webb, Washington Correspondent for the BBC. And we are joined now from Hanover, New Hampshire, by On Point News Analyst Jack Beatty, Senior Editor at The Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guest.
I think everyone who's heard this interview recognizes it as something different. I want to get right into it so our listeners can hear that as well. Let's start off with a clip from the top of the interview. Here's the BBC's David Dimbleby asking Donald Rumsfeld if war with Iraq is inevitable.
Has Saddam done anything in these last few weeks that make you think war is less likely?
Not really. I think the key is whether or not one comes to develop a conviction that he's cooperating. In other words, it isn't do the inspectors find things, because they're not discoverers or finders. It's really, is this during this period of inspections, is he demonstrating that he has in fact thrown in the towel and is going to cooperate?
Doesn't the destruction of Al-Samud missiles daily suggest that he has done that?
Well, I suppose to some it might. On the other hand, every single thing that he does that anyone could cite as cooperative was after some long period of denying, a refusal to do it, and ultimately a willingness to do part of it. And it is such a reluctant process that it would take so many years to ever really believe you'd done the task of disarming.
But even so, if you've got the inspectors there, if you've got Hans Blix talking about this as a very significant bit of disarmament, haven't you got him by the tail? So that as long as the inspectors are there, as long as Blix is there, he can't really do much damage to anyone.
Well, I think that the way to think about that is that there were inspectors there before, and he continued with his weapons of mass destruction programs. And the way he did it is he's learned how to live in an inspections environment.
But you're not saying with all your troops there, with the overflying you have, with the satellite information, that he could seriously go on creating weapons of mass destruction now?
Oh, sure. He does things underground. He's very skillful at denial and deception. There's no doubt in my mind but that he has weapons, chemical and biological weapons, and has been working on a nuclear weapon.
The deputy weapons inspector, Perikos, says that the presence of inspectors in the country, I quote him, is preventing any prohibited activities from being regenerated. You think he's wrong?
I would think that it's a very hard statement for him to make because he doesn't have access to the underground systems and the tunneling and the skill that they have in deceiving. I mean, if you think of the number of Iraqi minders, people who tenders, they go along with the inspectors. If you think of the fact that we've not been able to get people outside the country with their families so that they could talk honestly. If you think about the declaration that was submitted, which everyone agreed was fraudulent. It would be difficult for me to make that statement.
You're skeptical about the inspectors and their role altogether?
Well, I wouldn't say altogether. I think inspections can work. They can work with a cooperative country like they did with South Africa or Kazakhstan or any other country that decided that it was in their interest to disarm. And what they really were looking for was not someone to come in and discover things, but they were looking for someone to come in and prove to the world that they had in fact disarmed. That's a very different thing. So there's a good role for inspectors. And I think during this period, people have to make a judgment about that.
But frankly, can you see from your point of view any disarmament in Iraq that would satisfy you it had happened without Saddam going? Or in effect, does Saddam have to go from your point of view?
Well, my point of view is not very important.
Why not?
Because the President of the United States is going to make those judgments. Right. And certainly not me. My task is quite different. Colin Powell's the one working with the inspectors, and the Central Intelligence Agency is cooperating with it, as are other intelligence agencies in the world. And at some point, they will then make a judgment as to whether or not he's cooperating.
Colin Powell, Donald Rumsfeld, speaking Monday night with BBC anchorman David Dimbleby in Washington. The interview starts off soft, but it gets much, much tougher, and tougher for a Secretary of Defense who is not used to being pushed around much by the American press. We're going to be listening to extended excerpts of the interview tonight as we approach, apparently, war with Iraq for a bit of a different perspective on the Secretary's views. Winkled, cajoled, and sometimes pushed out of him by a BBC correspondent, we're joined tonight by On Point News analyst Jack Beattie and by Washington Post National Security and Military Affairs correspondent Dana Priest. Dana, you've read this interview. You see where it goes. I don't know if you've heard the entire tone of it yet, but Donald Rumsfeld is not at this point accustomed to being thrown off his stride very often in Washington, is he?
Well, not from the podium often at the Pentagon, but I feel like I need to come to the defense of some of my colleagues who routinely question him. The Pentagon briefings, he is a master at turning those into his message, often in a charming way, apparently. People mm-hmm. write books about him and think he's wonderful, and he ranks up there as the sexiest man in the world or something like that. But I have to say, colleagues who have taken him on in different forums in his office, often usually with transcribers, and they put these interviews on the website, the defenselink.mil website right afterwards, they get into it with him. And it's often no holds barred with them, and they are the press corps that know him much better. Bob Woodward's interview with him, it became quite testy. Tom Ricks from our office mm-hmm. has done that too. So he's a wrestler by profession.
Yes.
I don't think the press corps is quite as soft overall as they may come across on the television. Everybody knows the television cameras are on, and some of them don't care to mix it up with him in front of those cameras.
So, Jack Beattie, Dana Priest says off scene, U.S. press goes at Donald Rumsfeld hammer and tongs, but on air, that's not the impression we have of this Secretary of Defense.
Not at all. Some years ago, there was a book written about the Washington Press Corps called On Bended Knee, and that, I think, could describe a lot of what we see on the tube, and that's for a couple of reasons. In the first place, these reporters are prisoners of access. They've got to come back the next day and talk to people there, and if they get people's backup, the chances of doing that are limited. Second, their range of sources get limited to the sort of, you know, immediate military issue. I mean, no one ever goes outside the box and says, well, wait a minute. If, for example, in the Vietnam reporting of David Halberstam a generation ago, he was really saying, well, here's how to fight the war better. He wasn't going outside the range of assumption and saying, this war is crazy, is it?
We're going to get a big nose full of this tonight, Jack. We've got to take a break right now. We're breaking our normal format just a little tonight to bring you something out of the ordinary, excerpts from a strikingly tough and candid interview of Donald Rumsfeld on what looks like the eve of war. What do you hear? In tough questioning from across the pond, you can join us, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are breaking out of our normal format just a little tonight to bring you something out of the ordinary, excerpts from a strikingly tough and candid interview of Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld on what looks like the eve of war. He was interviewed on Monday night by BBC anchor David Dimbleby. It's challenging, it's argumentative, and unlike anything that most of us have heard in the American press in a long time, completely out of the bubble of U.S. media coverage. We're going to hear more very soon. We're joined tonight by Dana Priest, National Security and Military Affairs Correspondent with The Washington Post, and now from Washington by Justin Webb, Washington Correspondent for the BBC. Good evening and welcome, Justin Webb.
Good evening. Good to be here.
Thank you for joining us. Justin Webb, we're going to hear more of this, a lot of it, and soon, but just very quickly, your sense of the way that we hear David Dimbleby, the BBC anchor, going at Donald Rumsfeld here, compared to what we hear from Donald Rumsfeld on Mount Olympus at the Pentagon press podium.
Oh, well, you put your finger on it there, don't you? Because he's on Mount Olympus at the press podium, and you can't press him. And, you know, you've got dozens of journalists, each with their own questions to ask, and you can't get any kind of sense of rhythm. You can't press him properly on a point. So I, too, would sort of spring to the defense, actually, of American journalists at the at the Pentagon. But what they don't have is half an hour with the guy just sitting there, man to man, and Dimbleby is a, you know, a man of not quite of Rumsfeld's age, but he's getting on that way, actually. And so these are two equals. Dimbleby is a hugely experienced man, a man who's been around an awful lot, rather like David Frost.
And very well positioned in his own right. His father was a lion of the British press. He's a big anchor man. He's rich in his own right, as I understand.
His father invented the interview on British television, it's fair to say, and they then owned, a chain of newspapers. He's an independently wealthy man. He's a man who, I tell you, he interviewed all the candidates to be prime minister in Britain, not the last election, but the one before that. And my impression was that he was far and away the best candidate himself, actually. And that included Tony Blair. He wasn't, of course, then. He hadn't been prime minister. So he is a man of considerable weight. And he had half an hour with the guy. And the problem with if there is a problem with the American media, it's not so much the people asking the questions or the intelligence or anything like that. It's just that you don't have the attention span. You're not allowed to by the people who run the shows, you can't get. I mean, this ran on primetime TV in Britain, and it just wouldn't happen here.
Listening to this, we wish we had more of it. Let's hear more of the BBC and Donald Rumsfeld nose-to-nose. Here's David Dimbleby questioning Rumsfeld on his stance on old Europe.
So what do you say to what the French are putting forward? You need more time, things are working. I mean, the French Foreign Minister yesterday, for instance, and I know your view of France is that it's old Europe and you don't really count it or rank it very high. But he said, you can't
I don't know that you ought to be putting words in my mouth.
Well, you call them old Europe. I don't.
What I did was I was asked a question about Europe being opposed to the U.S. position. And my response was that there were a couple of countries that were opposed and that a large number of countries were supportive. The eight countries had already signed and 10 countries later signed. And I said the center of gravity is shifting in Europe. I was thinking of NATO when I said old Europe. I was thinking old NATO because the next sentence, old NATO is at 15, the new NATO is at 26 countries, and the center of gravity has shifted. It was not disparaging of any of those countries. Those countries are allies with us in NATO.
And so were you surprised they got so upset by it? I mean,
well,
President Chirac was extremely upset by this.
Yeah, I was surprised, to be very honest. It was. I mean, I served as ambassador to NATO. I've got a great many friends in both of those countries, and I think that it is more an indication of a sensitivity that surprised me.
Well, they're sensitive because you don't take their argument seriously.
Well, of course we do. If people said there should be more time, the president has given them more time.
Well, let's just go back to the French foreign minister and what he said yesterday. You can't say, I want Saddam to disarm. He's talking about the American administration. And at the same time, when he is disarming, saying they're not doing what they should. I mean, a lot of people in Europe, and I suspect a lot of people in this country, from what one hears, think that is the case and think that you are piling on the pressure because whatever happens, you don't want war, but you want to get rid of Saddam. And that's really what's behind it.
Well, I suppose anyone can decide what they think is behind it and what motives are. The President of the United States is very clear on what his intent is, what his words say is what he means. And he's said it very clearly, and he's provided leadership on this. And he has said to the international community and to our Congress that he really believes it's important that that Iraq be disarmed. It is not the job of the Secretary of Defense to be involved in those issues. I'm not. You keep saying you. I suppose you mean you, the United States.
No, I see you as part of the senior part of the administration as well.
Well,
as
I am, sure.
Defense, indeed.
But the job of a Secretary of Defense is quite different than making those judgments. Those judgments are judgments the President makes, and I work for the President, and I happen to agree with his statements, and I support him.
Are people who want to defer war appeasers?
No, I've never used that word. I think these are very tough issues. I think that the 21st century is a different century. We're in a different security environment. And people have got to think through what it means, what this new security environment means. And I think probably one of the differences is that the United States was the country that was attacked on September 11th. And so there's a great deal of support for the President's position. It wasn't some of the European countries that was attacked on September 11th, and their publics and their leadership look at this somewhat differently. It seems to me that that's to be expected. When you take very difficult issues about the fact that we could have a September 11th where not 3,000 people were killed, but maybe 30,000 could be killed, or 300,000 could be killed. And then the question is, well, what do you do about that? And those are big ideas. They're big concerns, and people need time to discuss them.
And yet
so using words like you used, and I did not.
The Prime Minister of Britain used the words, not me.
I
about
don't.
Appeasers.
Yes.
I mean, he used it in the context of the way that people treated Hitler, and they said the appeasers may have been well-intentioned, but they were wrong.
Well, there's no question but that people in that period who were looking for a peaceful way with Adolf Hitler were proven wrong.
Donald Rumsfeld in the hot seat here with BBC anchorman David Dimbleby in an interview that took place Monday, was aired yesterday on national television in Britain. We're airing excerpts of it tonight just to get a sense of Rumsfeld in a different light, not Rumsfeld standing tall at the podium, but Rumsfeld down and dirty with a journalist who keeps coming at him. We're joined tonight by Justin Webb, Washington correspondent for the BBC, and Dana Priest, national security and military affairs correspondent for the Washington Post, author of the new book, The Mission, and our own Jack Beatty. Dana Priest, several things here that leave one wondering if Donald Rumsfeld is wriggling off the hook a little bit or backpedaling. Do you buy his explanation of what he meant by old Europe? We all saw him make that statement, but we probably didn't see him make it in as full a context as you did. It did seem a taunt to a Europe, France and Germany headed into the musty days of yesteryear, not something about the distant founding of NATO. Here he says he meant old NATO.
Yes, and after that, the administration followed that up with their own snickering and piling on, if you will, from other podiums. So I think the message was pretty clear. The backlash was pretty clear, too. People didn't appreciate that, certainly in Europe, although I must say it did you saw the boycotters out, boycott French wine, so the reaction went both ways in this country, and they're always playing to different audiences, and they usually get very different reactions here, which I think reflect the deep division in the country about the war itself and certainly about how the administration has pursued the policy and just how we are not only vis-a-vis Iraq but also North Korea.
And maybe something about how the administration is portrayed. Justin Webb, what about in the comment on appeasers? Rumsfeld here rejects that as a notion, but when he hears Tony Blair has used it, he seems to come back and embrace it.
Yes, he does, doesn't he? That's interesting, that. I mean, he was obviously sort of trying his best to be on his best behavior, wasn't he, throughout the whole half hour? That was the impression I got.
Trying,
and actually generally succeeding, because Dimbleby does needle him again and again and try to get him to take the bait, but he
and
didn't.
In fairness, Rumsfeld does get his message across, and it's a message that we know, and he's sticking to it.
Yeah.
But not necessarily sticking to the flourishes, not the old Europe, and not the implication of appeasement.
Yeah, exactly. He manages to get the message across, but he doesn't get led down too many paths that would be too dangerous to him. And the interesting thing about the interview is Dimbleby's attempts and Rumsfeld being unused to kind of people trying two or three times along one tack. And that's certainly that appeasement line. Apparently, there were all sorts of dangers there for Rumsfeld. He couldn't resist at the end of the day agreeing once he'd heard that Tony Blair had made the suggestion. No, but he didn't go down it himself.
And Jack Beattie, clarity and candor on ultimate U.S. aims here. Regime change is not something he was willing to embrace there. And yet...
It's regime change. There's no question about it. You know, there's a really important point of substance to be made here about what he said earlier. He was saying that the inspectors don't have access, quote, to the underground systems and the tunneling. He told the Washington Post this, quote, if the inspectors have found something, the argument might be that the inspections were working and, therefore, we should give them more time. In other words, and then on Monday, we have this from Tom Ricks. The pace of special forces operations will be stepped up. Their main focus will be denying access to certain chemical and biological weapon sites that can't be bombed for fear of toxic plumes. In other words, we know where these sites are, but we're not telling the inspectors. And we're not doing it deliberately. We are subverting the inspection regime. It isn't just that they're going out there, as he says, well, they're not supposed to be looking. We're not telling them what we know, because if they found the stuff and destroyed it, one of the bases for the war would be gone.
Maybe, but then maybe they just don't trust the inspectors to deal as effectively with it as the U.S. military may. Let's hear some more. Here Dimbleby probes Rumsfeld on his own personal previous dealings with Iraq.
In what way is Iraq a threat to the United States that would allow it to act in self-defense of American interests?
The issue that's before the world, it seems to me, is the pervasiveness of weapons of mass destruction and the spread of these, the proliferation of these technologies, chemical and biological weapons, increasingly nuclear weapons. We could, in 10 years, have doubled the number of nuclear powers in the world. The situation with Iraq is that we're at the end of the string. We've tried diplomacy for 12 years. We've tried economic sanctions, and they have not worked. The effort on the part of the international community to prevent him from having those things that enable him to develop those capabilities failed. And he was not contained, and he was not in a box. And even limited military action in the North and the South has really not done it. The critical issue is the relationship between weapons of terror states, which Iraq is by everyone's agreement.
America took it off the list of terror states 20 years ago.
I don't know that.
When you visited Iraq and negotiated with Saddam Hussein, when America wanted Saddam Hussein for its own purposes, America took Iraq off the list of terrorist states and indeed supplied it with the wherewithal to make the chemical weapons they're now trying to remove.
Well, I've read that type of thing, but I don't know where you get your information, and I don't believe it's correct. They may have been taken off. I was a private businessman and was asked for a few months to assist after the 241 Marines were killed in Beirut, Lebanon. And I did meet with Saddam Hussein. I did not give him or sell him or bring him any chemical weapons or any biological weapons, as some of the European press likes to print. It's just factually not true. Now, whether or not the United States at some point, when I was not part of the government, decided to take him off a terrorist list, you may be right. In fact,
are you saying you don't know, you didn't know when you went there whether he was on the list of terror states or not? You were trying to reopen
a
relationship between the United States and Iraq.
That's right, and I believe he was on the list of terror states when I went there.
We're being diverted a bit here, but let's just go into this, because it's another of the causes of a lack of credibility, or a credibility gap that you particularly have to fill. That you were there, met the man.
I was asked by the president and Secretary Shultz to meet with him and to see. That was one of the few Middle Eastern countries that had not reestablished relationships with the United States after the earlier Middle East war.
But you're not saying that you weren't aware that he was using chemical weapons, because the Secretary of State at the time had said they were using them.
I was certainly aware of that. I didn't say I wasn't aware of that. I said that I was not aware that the United States gave him, as you suggested, or I gave him, and that I had some burden to bear. That's just utter nonsense.
I wasn't suggesting you had a burden to bear. I was saying that there was one of the reasons you lacked.
You said you particularly had
well,
that.
Well, you went and talked to the man.
I did.
But what I'm suggesting is that the United States, in the world outside, over and over again, people say, well, now they're trying to get rid of the weapons, as Jesse Jackson put it when he was at Hyde Park Corner a week ago, for which the United States has the receipts. I mean, that's the problem, that you created this monster
you
of evil,
who,
as you,
you
know.
You,
the United States, not you personally.
Well, first of all, you're wrong. If you look at the record of the European countries and the other technologically advanced countries of the world and the relationships with Iraq, I think you'll find that the United States ranks relatively low in terms of trading with Iraq and assisting Iraq with respect to weapons. I think that's correct. I don't have the data, but I think you'll find that's the case. And I think, furthermore, that if it's at some point a ground truth is achieved, it'll be embarrassing to countries that have been providing Saddam Hussein's regime with a great deal of those technologies.
U.S. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld being interviewed on Monday night by BBC anchorman David Dimbleby. Justin Webb, I wonder in this section, it's arresting, we can't help but listen, we've got Donald Rumsfeld squirming, but is this really fair, or is this just baiting? I mean, does it matter that the U.S. took Iraq off the terror list 20 years ago? What does that matter now?
It's context, and this is why the Europeans go on and on about this, because that was then and this is now, but then and now is linked. It is linked by the continuum that is history. You can't deny your past or attempt to bury it and then expect people to take fully seriously what you're saying now. What you need to do, as Rumsfeld tried to do there, is explain that that was the past and what has changed. And of course, if you make that point, then I guess reasonable people might go along with you.
I still can't help wondering if this is just, you know, brandishing a quick English tongue to slap the secretary around the ears. Dana Priest, Donald Rumsfeld says here, when all is said and done, when we get to a ground truth, as he calls it, we may see some red faces in other countries. It sounds like a reference to France, maybe, who have delivered weapons to Iraq much more recently.
Yes, but I think the issue about context is really relevant, and it's directly linked to credibility, and it's directly linked to the dispute that we have with our allies or that the government has with the allies over how to interpret Saddam Hussein now. He was tilting towards him during the Iran-Iraq war previously, other than invading Kuwait, which was a big deal, but other than invading Kuwait, until 9/11, there was really no indication that he had made pacts with terrorists or was developing weapons that he would then use against us in an offensive way. The CIA said that many times. 9/11 comes along, and now the administration wants to say and trying to make the case that there is a new link there, and that is the centerpiece for why now. And people disagree with the interpretation of those facts, that there is indeed a link now. So I do think it's very instructive to go back to history, not to say that things don't change, but in this case, there hasn't been a lot that's changed, except we got attacked by Osama bin Laden, which changed not only the world for us, but also our interpretation of people's motives and their possible motives in the future.
And whatever we make of this interview, it's simply not an interaction that we hear often, perhaps not often enough, in the American press, that kind of context press. Maybe we take it for granted. We are breaking our normal format tonight to bring you something out of the ordinary, excerpts from a strikingly tough interview of Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld on what looks like the eve of war by a BBC anchorman. You can view the entire Rumsfeld interview at our website, onpointradio.org. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. If you're just joining us, we are breaking out of our normal format just a little tonight to bring you something out of the ordinary, excerpts from a strikingly tough and candid interview of Donald Rumsfeld, Secretary of Defense, on what looks like the eve of war, interviewed Monday night by BBC anchor David Dimbleby. It's challenging, it's argumentative, and unlike anything most of us have heard in the American press in a long time, completely outside the bubble of U.S. media coverage to most of our ears. My guests tonight are Dana Priest, she's National Security and Military Affairs correspondent for The Washington Post, and Justin Webb, Washington correspondent for the BBC. Our Jack Beatty is with us as well. You're welcome to join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I must tell you, in fairness, we have a lot of calls coming in and not much time with these excerpts to take them, but we'll take one right now. Jay's on the air. Hi, Jay.
Hi, Mr. Ashbrook. fantastic program as usual. I wanted to actually get the opinions of your people you have there today about the non-iconoclasm of the present core of American reporters. I think it's because the present generation of reporters have grown up under, you know, with certain assumptions, and they kind of tend to give the government the benefit of the doubt with regards to certain basic things. One of the things is that the United States is indeed a force for good. That is a given in many of these interactions. Also,
in the U.S. press, you're saying, Jay, your line's breaking up, but I'm going to take it right there. Justin, let me put it to you. As the BBC Observer, Jay puts it interestingly, not enough iconoclastic perspective in the American press. He's suggesting a kind of a lockstep, a fundamental assumption of American goodness. Well, we're raised to have it here.
Yes, you are raised to have it here, and it's not all a bad thing, I think. I mean, there are many aspects to the press here that are much more civilized and civilizing than those in Britain, and your papers at their best are much more educative, and your broadcasting as well gives much more space for many diverse opinions. But what you don't have is that edge that, I mean, frankly, Dimbleby is one of the gentlest of our interviewers, mm-hmm. of the main interviewers, but you don't have this feeling that the Prime Minister is a lying expletive deleted, and here the president and his immediate advisers are people who immediately, before you even open your mouth, command, with all of you, it seems to me, a certain degree of respect, and we frankly just don't have that in Britain.
Well, this cuts both ways. You know, I've read in the British press stuff that seemed like just made up out of thin air.
Exactly.
Sometimes
it is made up.
In situations, yeah. I've been abroad working as a correspondent, mm. and been happy to be with a bit more of a stolid American
Absolutely.
Press.
Yeah.
And yet, when the stakes are so high, we'd like tough questioning. We're going to hear more of this. Jay, thanks for your call. Let's turn back to the interview. Here, David Dimbleby talking with Donald Rumsfeld. In this excerpt, questioning U.S. credibility in the Arab world.
Can I come to the question which seems to me to be at the heart of all this, of the credibility of the United States position, which clearly exercises the British Prime Minister, the American President, and the administration, and one hears a lot of doubt cast on America's motives for this. Do you think you'd win more backing in the outside world if you'd spent a fraction of the time on the Israeli-Palestinian problem as you've spent on Iraq?
Well, probably. I think that the President and Secretary Powell have worked on the Palestinian Arab-Israeli problem a good deal in the past 2 years. Presidents made several speeches on the subject. Secretary Powell has been involved. There have been special envoys involved. That is a problem that's a tough one, and it's been a tough one my entire adult lifetime. And that it has not been solved in the last 20 months ought not to be a surprise to anybody. The president cares about it. He is concerned about it. He has addressed it. And I think that had there been success there, there would have been probably greater support. On the other hand, the implication of your question is that there is not great support. And there is great support. There are a very large number of nations that will be participating in a coalition of the willing in the event Saddam Hussein refuses to cooperate and force has to be used.
And yet America is seen as applying double standards in this, isn't it? I mean, using the UN against Iraq, for instance, and then you yourself repeating two or three times in the context of Israel and the UN resolutions there that the occupied territories on the West Bank are so-called occupied territories. That's the kind of thing that makes people think, well, actually, America's not serious about this. They're so pro-Israel.
Interesting.
They're not. Well, you said
well,
that.
Well, first of all, I did not repeat it two or three times. You're just factually wrong.
You said it twice in the same series of remarks. You used the expression so-called.
Fair enough. I was in a meeting, and I was asked a question, and the phrase came out.
But is what you think, that they're so-called occupied, or do you think they're occupied and should be given up?
I think that that's what a negotiation is going to solve. I mean, that is what the negotiation is about. Obviously, Israel is offered to give back a major portion of the occupied territories. We know that. The agreement was there. It could have been solved if Arafat had accepted it. He didn't.
But your use of the word so-called,
if it bothered you, then don't use it.
Not me it bothers. It's the other Arab states it bothers.
Well, don't you agree that a purpose of a negotiation is to decide those things? It seems to me that's a fairly reasonable.
Okay.
That the Israel has offered to give up a major percentage of the occupied territory.
And there's Donald Rumsfeld talking with the BBC's David Dimbleby. Here we get into hot stuff. Dana Priest, I don't know if in the Pentagon planners, strategists would put this in the same terms as David Dimbleby. He calls this question the question of Israeli-Palestinians and Palestinians at the heart of all this.
No, I think many people would. This is why this is my favorite part of the interview, because there is no one that I know who would say that the administration has spent as much time on this on the Palestinian-Israeli conflict as they have on Iraq, certainly not. And you see Rumsfeld trying to make the best case, not really doing the whole business about so-called was so revealing, I think. And he's trying to, you know, sum it up by saying, well, don't use it if you don't like it. I really didn't mean exactly what you're implying.
But doesn't he regularly use so-called? Isn't that his standard reference phrase?
Well, he has done it more than once. I can't say he does it all the time. But, it is revealing of a larger strategy on the part of the United States, which is to let Israel apparently do what it is doing now without any protest that I can really see, especially recently, from the United States government, meanwhile not sending any high-level delegations over there. So either they believe that Israel's strategy can work and that they can kill the enough Palestinians to make the movement go away. Lots of people disagree with that. Or they are waiting for the right time to begin a new peace dialogue, which doesn't, again, there's no proof that that's in the waiting. So I like to compare the words versus the deeds in this case.
Justin Webb, these questions dripping with a sentiment that we do not hear in questions often from the American press, that the charge of anti-Semitism is thrown up against Europe exactly off of this kind of approach.
Yes, and it's so telling, isn't it, that that little section would be an absolutely standard part of any reasonably educated European interviewer's stance towards Rumsfeld, and yet here it's almost a surprise, and he sounds quite surprised. And he sounds surprised that anyone thinks it matters whether he thinks they're so-called occupied territories or actually occupied territories. And yet, of course, it does go to the heart of what so many people across Europe say, this double standard on the UN and what the UN believes and whether the UN is worth working with in some circumstances and not in others. The anti-Semitism charge, this is my personal view, is that when the Bush administration and when prominent Americans talk about European anti-Semitism, and say that that has something to do with their European view of the Palestinian-Israeli problem, I think they're right, actually. I think there is a genuine, nasty, still existing sense, and it was expressed beautifully the other day in the New York Times by, I think it was Thomas Friedman, in a piece he wrote about it, where he said, you see all these Europeans on the streets demonstrating for Arab rights, but the only Arabs they're interested in terms of Arab rights, are those who they say are living under Israeli occupation and the Israeli thumb. They're never interested in Arab rights, for instance, those in other Arab nations where there are dictatorial governments, and certainly not, of course, in Iraq. And I think it's a fair point, actually, that could be well taken by the Europeans.
A fair point and a strong point. And yet it's interesting to watch the Secretary dance over this phrase, occupied or so-called occupied. A lot to read there. We don't read it often. Let's get one final clip in here. Here's Dimbleby questioning Rumsfeld on American plans for future military activities against other nations in the axis of evil.
Do you have any plans for any further military activity apart from in Iraq, in the Middle East?
First of all, we don't discuss military plans. And second, plans are plans. Our obligation in any Ministry of Defense in the world is to look at potential threats and capabilities that can threaten your country and develop appropriate contingencies. That's what we do. That's our job. You're asking a question that should be asked the president. Does he have anything specific that he intends to do in the event force has to be used in Iraq? And that's a question for the president to answer. But I can say this, he does intend to very definitely continue to pursue the global war on terrorism, which in fact he has been doing. We've got 90 nations in a coalition. It's probably the largest coalition in the history of mankind that are participating in a variety of different ways to try to track down terrorist networks and stop them from killing innocent men, women, and children. And that's a good thing to be doing. And there are a number of places in the Middle East where those terrorists are finding haven.
But
Iran is one of the countries.
You say,
and Iraq is one of the countries.
So Iran should be in your sights on those grounds.
I wouldn't use words like the hot button words like that in your sights. I think that that's not the case. I like the way I answered your question just fine.
You say that's a good thing. Aren't people, though, right to be suspicious, who aren't Americans, of one country, in effect, shaping the world to suit itself, to suit its own values?
Yeah. Well, first of all, now you're back to one country, as though the United States is acting unilaterally. In the global war on terrorism, there are 90 nations. Never in the history of mankind have there been that many countries working together on exactly the same project.
I'm only thinking of what the President said. The course of this nation does not depend on the decisions of others, i.e., even if it is true you have a number now, America will nevertheless go it alone if necessary. He said it.
Yeah. If any leader of any country were to say anything other than that they recognize their responsibility as the leader of those countries to defend those countries, they probably wouldn't be in office. There's no question but that the obligation of the president under our Constitution is to defend our country.
Some of the history of the world and civilization was written by others. The rest will be written by us. I mean, there is a sort of American empire seeming to burgeon here in the language that's being used.
Interesting. I don't find it that way. Let me give you an example of why I don't find it that way. If you think of how powerful and lethal biological weapons are, nuclear weapons are, they can kill hundreds of thousands or millions of people. I mean, smallpox, put in three locations in a country, can kill a million people in a matter of months. Now, that's a serious problem for the world. There's nothing the United States can do about that alone. We have to work with other countries. It takes the cooperation of other countries. Other publics have got to engage this issue. Other governments have to engage this issue. Look at the problem with North Korea. The United States can't solve that alone. It takes the cooperation of a lot of countries if we're going to stop the proliferation of those weapons.
Donald Rumsfeld talking to the BBC. Jack Beattie, our time is very short. Iran in the gun sights here, America going it alone, American empire all on the table David Dimbleby's questioning.
Yes, and he's using the E word, which again is something you don't hear much from American reporters. I just want to underscore that point and return to something our questioner Jay brought up, which is this issue of the un-iconoclastic press. You know, it's really embodied in the person of Bob Woodward. He broke in doing the expose of Watergate. Now he is a court historian. He says he offers self-portraits of the elite. And, you know, he's considered by Americans to be our premier investigative reporter. Nothing could be further from the truth. He lets his tape recorder run, and he shows in his reporting in an extreme way the problem with the press endemically. That is, his horizon doesn't go beyond yesterday. History doesn't exist. So I think Jay is really onto something there.
Dana Priest, in a phrase, who wins in this interview? BBC, Rumsfeld, everybody?
I think it's a tie. They both did great jobs in making their points, but also the interviewer does a good job in revealing the weaknesses and contradictions in some of the administration's talking points.
And with that, we are out of time. Dana Priest, I want to thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Dana Priest is National Security and Military Affairs Correspondent for The Washington Post. Her new book is The Mission, Waging War and Keeping Peace with America's Military. And Justin Webb in Washington, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
Justin Webb is Washington Correspondent for the BBC. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by...